looking forward to the second part in this series on the blessing of Birkat Gomel and psychology, which Revezer will tell us more about. So take it away, Revezer. Thanks for being here and being up late to learn with us.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me back. I'm really excited to learn together again. So, okay, great. So let's get started. I'm going to share my screen.
Oh, my camera's not on. That's why. I have to reboot the computer.
So hi, everyone. I'll just interrupt for a second and just ask that everyone, if you can place yourself on mute, please do so. And anytime that you'd like to say something, you can feel free to unmute.
Awesome. Okay, great. Thanks. So can everybody see my screen? And can people hear me okay and see me okay? Okay, awesome. Great. So the way that screen sharing is set up is I can't see everybody at once. So if you have a question, I might not see your hand. So just interrupt. That's fine. So welcome back to part two of the series. I am really excited to learn together tonight. And part one, for those who weren't there or who want a refresher, we discussed whether the obligation, I could stop the screen share for this part, just so we could all look at each other. Anyway, we discussed whether the obligation, you know, according to most, the obligation to recite Birkat HaGomel applies to recovery from mental illness. And our answer was kind of, was a little bit complex. You know, the answer is sometimes, you know, just like any other illness, it can be, but there's no all or nothing, everything is okay or everything is prohibited answer. And in general, we can perhaps say that last week was a look at Birkat HaGomel and mental illness. And today I want to explore the flip side of that, which is kind of Birkat HaGomel and mental wellness. So I just want to give a brief introduction to the general topic of well-being, because that's super important for what we're going to talk about tonight. And it also happens to be an increasingly popular focus of psychological attention. And I just am curious what people are thinking. When I say the word psychology, feel free to blurt out, what words and phrases come to mind? Could be anything. There's no wrong answers.
Therapy.
Great.
Mental health issues.
I would think understanding of the human condition.
Understanding of the human condition, for sure.
Understanding behavior.
Okay, great. Those are any of the last thoughts? Okay. So those are all, you know, definitely related to psychology in very, very important ways. And I think it's interesting, though, to point out that I think the answers that we just heard, at least to some extent, would not have been the same answers that we would have heard if this year was given 2 decades ago. And I think the reason for that is because there's been a shift in contemporary psychology and focus, really, from thinking about mental illness and emotional pain and turmoil towards thinking more broadly about the human condition and even the positive aspects of the human condition, like flourishing. Like, how does someone not just avoid being down, but how does someone really flourish and do really, really well in life? You know, in the words of one of the most prominent trailblazers in psychology, Martin Seligman, he said, you know, the aim of to catalyze a change in psychology from a preoccupation only with repairing the worst things in life to also building the best qualities in life. And that's really what wellness is at its heart, and what the study of psychological wellness is at its heart. It's really reshifting the focus from how do we recover or repair things in life that are going really, really difficultly or are really, really hard, to thinking proactively about how to foster self-actualization and going all the way to the other extreme of just really, you know, rocking it. So I think that what I want to do tonight together is explore two strategies for well-being, for practicing well-being in our own lives. And if the Torah doesn't work out, then at least we'll have, you know, two psychological strategies. But I want to argue, and I guess my thesis really is that Birkat HaGomel, and especially its requirements and the halachot that govern and surround it, are uniquely formulated to help us foster well-being in the two ways that we're going to talk about. So how does that sound? Good? Any questions? Okay, great. So in order to do that, we're going to do a little bit of reading, Jewish texts, but also secular psychological texts. But before we start, I just want to get us into things and orient anybody who wasn't at the first session and even just review briefly to just reframe Birkat HaGomel specifically. So now I'm going to share my screen. And see, like last time, people can see the screen. Great. Awesome. So we have here in source number one, which basically is the formative text, the Talmudic basis, really the first time our tradition talks about Birkat HaGomel. And it says in the Talmud, in Masechet Brachot, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Arba Atzrichim Lehodot, that according to Rav, there are four individuals who need to give thanks. Yordei Hayam, people who survive a sea journey. Holchei Mibarot, people who survive a desert journey. Mishahaya Cholav Nitrape, someone who was sick and recovered. Umishahaya Chavush Beveta Asurim Viyatsa, and somebody who was imprisoned in a prison situation that was dangerous and was freed from prison. The idea being that in specific circumstances of danger, and there's a machloket, whether it's just these four circumstances or any circumstance that's dangerous, but in circumstances of danger, upon recovering or emerging from the dangerous situation, one is obligated to give thanks. And the Gemara, it's not on this part of the source sheet, but goes on to specifically provide the precise formula for that thank you blessing. It actually turns out it's specifically a blessing. In the times of the temple, sometimes people would also offer korbanot as a way of giving thanks, but now we don't have that. We only have the Davar Amud of Halacha. We have the bracha itself. And, you know, what emerges from this passage in the Talmud is really that upon emergence from a dangerous situation, whether that's illness or a dangerous prison, one is obligated to give thanks to God. And that's Birkat HaGomel in a nutshell. And HaGomel, the word HaGomel, Birkat Bracha, and the word HaGomel means bestowed, as a nod to the goodness that God bestowed upon us when God saved us from the danger that we were in. And so the first way, Birkat HaGomel, is an expression of gratitude, then the first way that Birkat HaGomel can help us foster wellness, which is maybe really intuitive, is by cultivating gratitude itself. And it's really no secret that gratitude is an important part of wellness. In source number two, there's just so many sources in journals and in books about the value and the power of gratitude. And here, this specific study I thought was important because it was a meta-analysis, which basically means that it studied other studies. And it basically took hundreds of other studies on gratitude and then summarized the findings. And so when you look at a meta-study, you can get a really, you know, a bird's eye view of the actual literature. Instead of just reading one study, you get a general summary of here's the trend in all of the studies on gratitude. So this was a very important study on gratitude. It was done in 2017 by Leah Dickens. And she wrote that she found that the largest effects were seen for gratitude conditions compared to negative intervention conditions at post. Here's the important part. The results suggested that gratitude interventions can have positive benefits for people in terms of their well-being, happiness, life satisfaction, grateful mood, grateful disposition, positive affect, decrease in depressive symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. The point being that gratitude can be a really powerful tool in facilitating wellness and emotional well-being. And there are specific ways, and the literature talks about what are the most effective ways to express gratitude. But it usually means something, either writing or verbal, writing out a list of things you're grateful for, stating things that one is grateful for. Gratitude is super important and it's super psychologically relevant. And just as an aside, I posted here, gratitude is actually the reason why we're called Jews today. We're called the Jewish people. And, you know, if you look in Bereishit, so the truth is that we're called Jews because we, most of us descend from Shevet Yehuda, from the tribe of Judah. And Judah himself was given the name Judah for Yehuda for a particular reason. The Torah says in Bereishit in Parakaf Tet, Vatar od batele bein, that when Leah, Imenu, had a child, Vatomer papamode et Hashem al kin kra'a shemo Yehuda. She said that this time I will thank God. It says praise the Lord here, but I think the more proper translation is thank God. And therefore she named him Yehuda from the word hodaya, from the word thank you, hoda'a. And so Rashi there comments, that by giving me Judah, remember that Leah and Rachel were sort of competing for children. And by getting Judah, she had really gotten more than her share of the boys. And she wanted to, and therefore she wanted to give thanks. And if you, so Judah was called Yehuda because he wanted to give thanks, and then he developed into the tribe of Yehuda, which most of us descend from. And so that's actually, you know, gratitude is essentially the reason why we're actually called Jews. So it's, you know, it's super important. And Birkat HaGomel then, as an expression of gratitude, fits easily into the imperative of wellness psychology. And you know, that's really the first thing that I wanted to point out. Maybe it's really intuitive, but I thought it was really important. And it was hard for me to, you know, have a shiur on Birkat HaGomel and mental wellness with, by, you know, without mentioning the most obvious connection between HaGomel and mental wellness, which is the connection to gratitude, and Birkat HaGomel essentially being a statement of gratitude in the first place. So, okay, hold on. I lost the sheet. There it is. Great. Okay. So, okay. Now, if it's okay with you, and just for anybody who joined, I don't see whose hand is up all the time. So if you have a question, feel free to interrupt. Great. So let's move on. And, if it's okay, I'd like to get a little bit deeper into the field of, wellness psychology. We've got a little bit of reading to do. And we're just, before we start that, I want to look at some of the specific halachot, really like the choreography of Birkat HaGomel, how it happens, how it's set up, in order to prime us for this, what I thought was a really, really cool and incisive passage in a specific book that we're going to look at. But the first is that chapter in Psalms in Tehillim in Kapitel Kuf Zayin, chapter 107, David HaMelech writes, V'romimuhu b'kahal am v'moshav zekeinim yehalleluhu. Let people exalt God in the congregation of the people and acclaim God in the assembly of elders. And so it's clear from that pasuk in Tehillim that there's a value to thanking God in the presence of other people. So much so that the Gemara in source number 7 actually records the statement of Abaye. Abaye Amar v'tzarich le'oduye kame yasara dichti vayimremuhu kol am. That Abaye actually uses this Tehillim, this pasuk in Tehillim, to prove that there's a requirement to give thanks when one is reciting Birkat HaGomel in the presence of 10. And so one of the halachot for Birkat HaGomel is that it has to be recited in the presence of 10. Now, whether that means 10 men or 10 women and where the 10 have to be is a discussion for another time. But the point is that Birkat HaGomel is not supposed to be a solitary endeavor. It's supposed to be done in the presence of other people, and it's effectively a social experience in some way. Okay, does that make sense? Great. The second halacha of Birkat HaGomel, although I'm a little bit reticent to call it a halacha because I am not aware of any source for the ruling of the Rambam that we're about to read. It's not in any Gemaras that I'm aware of. I actually looked in a sefer called Kiryat Melech. Kiryat Melech is a sefer by one of the great rabbis of our generation, Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky. And it's basically him going through Rambam's entire halachic corpus, giving the sources for things that are not intuitive and hard to find. And he doesn't have a section on this line of the Rambam. So I'm really not sure where what the Rambam writes is coming from, but the Rambam writes it and other codifiers write it, including the Shulchan Aruch, and it's actually become a part of the Birkat HaGomel experience. So let's see what the Rambam says. The Rambam asks the question. He says, Ketzad modev ketzad mevarech. How does one thank God and recite Birkat HaGomel? The Rambam says, Omei b'nehen umevarech. One stands in the midst of the people, like Abaye said in source number 7, Vayiru memuhu bikal am, that it's supposed to be said in the presence of others, and then says, Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu melech ha'olam ha'gomelech ha'yim tovot shegmalani kol tov, that blessed are you, our God, who has bestowed kindness upon the undeserving. Why we call ourselves undeserving of the kindness in this blessing is a whole other conversation. But that's what the Rambam says is recited. V'chol hashomin am omrim, and this is the key part. This is the part that I couldn't find the source for. If anybody has, please tell me. V'chol hashomim omrim, everybody who listens, who is present when the individual who is reciting this bracha recites this bracha, says, shegimalcha tov hui gimalcha sala, that who has bestowed good upon you, namely God, may they bestow good upon you in the future. May God bestow good upon you in the future. And so the Rambam really takes it a step further than the Gemara. The Gemara says that Birkat HaGomel must be recited in the presence of other people. But it seems to me like the Rambam is saying that it's not actually enough that it's recited in the presence of other people, but it's actually an interactive experience where you're saying something and the community is responding to what you're saying. And so with these two halachot in mind, I'd like to turn to a book. I actually have the copy right here. It's called Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle. It's a pretty modern book. It came out in 2019, and it's all about burnout and emotions. Burnout is a topic that I feel personally very connected to, aside from experiencing it. Sometimes I actually also researched burnout in a lab in medical residence, which was a really special experience for me. I learned a lot from that. And so what I want to read is, you know, an admittedly long passage. And if it's okay, I'll invite someone to read if they're, whoever is comfortable with it, and take turns reading. The whole thing is in English. In between, it's really like three main paragraphs, and in between each paragraph, we'll summarize each paragraph and debrief a little bit until we get to the end. But I really kept looking at this 100 different ways, and I really thought that it was important to really understand it fully, to read it actually inside and in its full extent. I think there's ellipses in there. So cool. So is anybody, starting from the word stress, does anybody want to read or feel comfortable reading that paragraph? The English is pretty easy. If no one's comfortable with it, that's totally fine. But I just wanted to invite someone.
I can do it.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Okay, it says, stress is an evolutionary adaptive response that helps us cope with things like, say, being chased by a lion or charged by a hippo. When your brain notices a lion or hippo, it activates a generic stress response, a cascade of neurological and hormonal activity that initiates physiological changes to help you survive. Epinephrine acts instantly to push blood into your muscles, glucocorticoids keep you going, and endorphins help you ignore how uncomfortable all this is. Your heart beats faster, so your blood pumps harder, so your blood pressure increases and you breathe more quickly. Your muscles tense, your sensitivity to pain diminishes. Your attention is alert and vigilant, focusing on short-term, here-and-now thinking. Your senses are heightened, your memory shifts to channel its functioning to the narrow band of experience and knowledge most immediately relevant to the stressor. Plus, to maximize your body's efficiency in this state, your other organ systems get deprioritized. Your digestion slows down and your immune functioning shifts. Your entire body and mind change in response to the perceived threat.
Awesome. Thank you. So the essentially what the book is saying. And by the way, I just realized I forgot to mention the book is, I didn't say anything about the authors. Emily Nagoski and Amelia Nagoski it's not a coincidence that they have the same last name. They're sisters, and they wrote a book together on one of them is a psychologist, I think, or a neuroscientist. And the other one is actually, I think, an auditory technician. They talk about how each of their experiences was uniquely relevant to this book. But what they're effectively arguing, and sorry that I forgot that as part of the introduction, but what they're effectively starting out as by saying is that stress is not only is it something that we feel, although to the extent that we feel things, they're always biologically based, but stress initiates, when we're exposed to a stressor, our body changes in lots of different ways. Almost our entire body is changed in response to a stressor, whether that's your heart beating faster, your digestive functioning slowing. Stress creates this massive change when we're being chased by a lion or a hippo or whatever other stressor it is, a massive shift in the way we function and live and breathe, etc. Okay, so does anybody want to take this next part?
Okay, I'll do it again. All so right. Here comes the lion. You are flooded with stress response. What do? You run. And then? Well, then there are only two possible outcomes. Either you get eaten by the lion or trampled by the hippo, or else you escape. You survive. You run back to your village and you shout for help. Everyone comes out and helps you slaughter the lion. You're saved. Yay. You love your friends and family. You're grateful to be alive.
Awesome. Thank you. And thank you for mercifully ignoring my typo and the word possible, because I was very illegible. I appreciate it. So thanks for reading that again. And what the point here is that when we experience stressors, the way we evolved to experience stressors happened the way that we usually experience stressors when we were developing as human beings, which was in tribes. And so therefore the threats that we were experiencing, they weren't deadlines at work or anything like that. They were specific, you know, animals or other tribes that, you know, threatened our existence and caused us stress. And when we were exposed to these stressors, we learned how to deal with those in specific ways that were unique to those stressors. And so, you know, when we were exposed to a stressor, you know, there's the famous fight or flight response, where somebody can either, you know, choose to stay and stick it out and fight the stressor, or can run away and try and escape the stressor. I'm going to continue reading. So after you run away from the lion, right, you escape, you run back to your village, you shout for help. Everybody comes out and helps you slaughter the lion. You're saved. And now what? The sun seems to shine more brightly as you relax into the certain knowledge that your body is a safe place to be. Together, the village cooks a lot of the lion and shares a communal feast. And then you all bury the parts that you can't use in an honoring ceremony. Hand in hand with the people you love, you take a deep, relaxing breath. Stress response cycle complete, and we all live happily ever after. Now, before we go on, does anybody have questions about that? Does that make sense, what we're saying so far? Just a thumbs up. Okay, awesome. I was a little worried with all, like, cutting out the ellipses to try and make it shorter, that I was going to miss the main idea, but I'm glad that it seems like I didn't. And now here's the main point. Our stress response is beautifully fitted to the environment where it evolved. The behavior that dealt with the lion was the behavior that completed the stress response cycle. And that makes it easy to assume, and this is the crux, that it's the elimination of the lion, the cause of the stress, that completes the cycle. But they actually write that the research shows that that's not actually true. So let's think about it. Does anybody want to read from Suppose until the end of Bolt, besides for Barry? If no one wants to, that's fine. But
I'll do it.
Thanks.
Okay. I think Michael.
Suppose you are running away from the lion when it's struck by lightning. You turn and see the dead lion, but you suddenly feel peaceful and relaxed. Do you feel suddenly peaceful and relaxed? No. You stop, puzzled, heart pounding, eyes darting in search of the threat. Your body still wants to run or fight or hide and cave and cry. The threat may have been dealt with by an act of God, but you're left still needing to do something to let your body know you're safe. The stress response cycle needs to complete, and just eliminating the stressor isn't enough to do that. So maybe you run back to your village and breathlessly tell your tribe what happened, and you all jump up and down and cheer and thank God for the lightning bolt.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Hank, you want to take over for the rest of this?
Without this, your body is still in full action mode. Because you haven't done anything, your body recognizes as a cue that you are safe. Your body is stuck in the middle of the stress response. You have to do something that signals to your body that you are safe, or else you'll stay in that site with neurochemicals and hormones degrading, but never shifting into relaxation, never getting the signal that they're safe.
Thanks so much. So in other words, the research shows that when we're exposed to a stressor, the stressor sets off a cascade of reactions in our body. And once that cascade of reactions in our body are set off, it has nothing to do with the actual stressor anymore. So you could shoot the lion, for example, but you would still be left with the stress happening in your body, all those neurological and biological, gastroenterological changes that we read about would still be happening to you in response to a stressor. And what they're really trying to do is to try and distinguish between the stress and the stressor. Sometimes dealing with the stressor might physically save our lives, but it isn't enough to put us into cool down mode. So they write, addressing the cause of the stress doesn't mean you've addressed the stress itself. Your body is soaked in stress juice, whatever that means, just waiting for some cue that you are now safe from the potential threat and can relax into celebration. Okay? Does anybody have, we're going to debrief that now, but does anybody just have any questions to orient us? And is there something specific that someone's working through? No? Okay. So essentially what the book is arguing and what the research really seems to demonstrate is that once we're exposed to a stressor, there's a specific cool down that we were evolved to have to go through, specifically running away, telling people about what happened and getting them to, you know, help us with kill the lion, help us involve in a celebratory feast. And the research shows that when people are involved in stressful events and the stressful event and the stressor is eliminated, like a lion being shot, that those people actually stay in stress mode long after the stressor has already been dealt with. Because what causes us to calm down once the stress cycle has been initiated, it's not simply elimination of the stressor. It's the whole, cycle of things that we usually go through to calm ourselves down, whether that's deep breathing or running away or celebrating with other people. To really get rid of the stress response, we have to do more than just eliminate the stressor. And that's really an important finding of, you know, contemporary wellness theory, because a lot of times in life what people do in order to extract themselves from stressful situations is they'll simply get rid of the specific thing that was stressing them off. But people don't necessarily intuitively know how to take care of all the, you know, the biological garbage, all the neurotransmitters that have built up in your head and need to be released. In fact, there's something called the freezes. Has anybody ever heard of this term, the freezes? It's a psychological, biological term that describes what humans and some animals do in order to handle stress. So interestingly enough, if you were to look at a gazelle in the wild being chased by a lion, so some gazelles escape. And some gazelles, I guess, fight back. I don't know if they fight back, but theory they could. But what a lot of gazelles will actually do is if the lion actually catches them, they'll play dead. in order to escape the threat. It's a last ditch response. That's so they'll literally freeze, and freeze is what the mind tells the body to do when it realizes that running away is not a viable option and fighting is not a viable option. And so what will happen is that the lion will catch the gazelle will freeze and play dead. The lion will think that the gazelle is dead and then run off to get its cubs because it's dinner time. And when the lion finally leaves to get its cubs, what happens? You would think that the gazelle actually gets up to run away, but that's not actually what happens. What actually happens is the gazelle will start shuddering and shivering and twitching and seizing. And the reason why scientists figured out is because the gazelle had so much stress response and so much neurotransmitter built up in it that moving its limbs is the only way for it to cycle that neurotransmitter, all the adrenaline and the cortisol out of its system. And then once it's sort of gone through the motions of shivering and shuddering, it'll finally run off. And so the research shows that when we're exposed to stressors, we sort of have the same thing going on in the sense that we can eliminate the stressor and the stressor will leave, but we'll have so much, you know, cortisol, whatever the stress hormones neurotransmitters are in our bodies still, that it doesn't actually get us out of the stressful mindset. And studies show that if someone, you know, handled their stressor by running away and telling their friends and family about it, they'll actually be much more calm than if the stressor went away like that by being shot or struck by a lightning bolt. And so it turns out that the things we do after we're safe, and this is the really important part, are the most important in overcoming and finally completing the stress response. It's not the elimination of the stress response cycle. It's not the elimination of the stressor, but it's the things that we do after we're already safe that tell our body, okay, it's the stressor's gone and it's time to calm down now. And so what I want to suggest, and I really don't have any more Makorot for this, it's just something that I was thinking about, is that Birkat HaGomel, you know, if we view Birkat HaGomel as more than just a ritual obligation that, you know, sometimes we dispense maybe even thoughtlessly, but if we do it with kavana and intentionality, Birkat HaGomel can actually help us complete the cycle. Because the way Birkat HaGomel is choreographed in the presence of others with their verbal affirmations of our thanks, as we read about, it sort of mimics the way that we were able to calm ourselves down way back in the evolution of our own development, when we used to run back to our tribe and have a festive meal and tell them what was going on. And so Birkat HaGomel maybe can actually help us facilitate emotional well-being in the aftermath of stressful and dangerous incidents by sort of serving as the ritual spiritual surface area for acknowledgement and celebration. Birkat HaGomel, in short, can help us complete the emotional cycle. And so I guess just to summarize, you know, we're evolved to deal with stress in a specific way by engaging in particular community-oriented rituals. And dealing with the stressor is not the same as dealing with the stress. And it's the importance, the things we do after we're done with the stress that actually tell our body that it's time to calm down. And so if we think about Birkat HaGomel as something that's performed not in the heat of the stress, but the next day at shul, or the next 3 days at shul, or the next 20 days in shul, in the presence of other people, where we sort of have this choreographed ritual where we say, I'm so thankful to God. And then everybody else in the room says, Misha Gemalcha Kotov, Huyu Gemalcha Kotov Sela, that they acknowledge the thing that happened and wish for it to have, you know, for continued kindness and success. So I thought that Birkat HaGomel fit really nicely into that idea. And maybe we can even rethink it as a tool that can help us facilitate emotional well-being as sort of a ceremony that helps us complete the cycle of the stress response. So I'm done. And just to summarize, I guess, in case, you know, if you didn't get the whole shiur, you can just pay attention now and get the whole thing. Wellness, you know, is an important and increasing focus of psychological research and attention. And Birkat HaGomel can help us facilitate wellness in two ways, maybe more. Maybe you'll think of some other ways too. But one on the most basic level is by cultivating gratitude. And then after we spoke about gratitude, we sort of we sort of shifted into the emotional cycle and talking about learning about the stress response and how, according to contemporary research, our bodies developed to know that a stressful situation is over, not upon elimination of the stressor, but via specific activities like celebration that happen in the stressor's aftermath. And so what I argued tonight, basically, based on the way Birkat HaGomel is performed, specifically in the presence of other people and in sort of a choreographed interactive ritual, that Birkat HaGomel can actually be potentially understood as sort of a final stamp ritual that helps us complete the emotional cycle of, you know, whatever stressful event caused us to recite Birkat HaGomel in the first place. That's the shir. I just want to open it up to any questions or comments or thoughts. Rabbi Albert, maybe after like the first two questions, you can take it off of live. So if anybody has any questions that they're, you know, they want to share more privately in the context of the intimacy of the group, then they could feel free.
That sounds good. I have a thought or slash question, but I'll wait for others to go first. I guess while we're waiting, I wonder if you think there are other rituals within our tradition, other mitzvot, that help kind of elicit a similar, I don't know if the word is catharsis or a cool down period post-stress. Now, I think of how the rabbis frame the mourning process, that you go from aninot, which is like the pre-burial moment where there's so much stress in the actual bringing the person to burial, and then you have a huge amount of catharsis that comes with the beginning of Shiva, providing food for the person in this really comforting way of a ritualized way to express comfort with Hamakom Yinachem. That seems to strike me as a really powerful way to kind of end the trauma loop, especially assuming that that being around a dying loved one could be really painful. I wonder if there are other mitzvot that you could think of that elicit a similar response.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. I think that there are lots of mitzvot that can sort of be reconceptualized as like deeply psychologically relevant. Something that comes to mind there are a few. There's actually a book called Life in the Balance, I think. It's by Dr. David Pelkovitz, who's a psychologist at YU, and his son, who's a rabbi, Rabbi Rafael Pelkovitz. They wrote it together. They specifically, I don't remember what, I mean, I have it on the shelf, but I don't want to waste much time looking through it. But they specifically talk about other specific rituals and how they're relevant. I think they speak about, you know, the offering of the Korban Todah as sort of, they don't talk about it. They talk about it. They don't talk about it from like completing the stress cycle way, but they talk about it in terms of gratitude, which is, you know, a shot in what the whole Todah offering is. I think it's cool to be creative about it. I don't know of anything else off the top of my head, but I'm sure there are examples.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I think it's interesting that the Korban Todah you just mentioned is in the Talmud, is the precedent for the blessing of Birkat HaGomel. Could you tell us a little bit more about what the Korban Todah is?
Yeah, I don't know so much about it. You might be in a better position to talk about it than I do. But correct me if I'm wrong, I think the basic idea is that when someone wants to give thanks, or in certain situations, someone might be obligated to give thanks, then they would go to the Beit HaMikdash and they would bring a specific type of offering as a Thanksgiving offering. It's probably worth noting that just in terms of what we were talking about the social nature of the ritual, that I think that the Korban Todah offering involved like a lot of bread, right?
40 loaves of bread.
Yeah, like a ton of bread. I think Sforno says on the pasuk that talks about giving the Todah that the reason why we need to bring so much bread is because we're supposed to give thanks in the presence of other people. And so we sort of have all this food to encourage us to bring others so that we can share it with them.
Yeah. I think it might be this foreigner who says the same. First of all, the Talmud says that it's the same kind of near death experiences that trigger the obligation to bring that offering in the temple of the Korban Torah. And I think that's why Birkat HaGomel was based on it. And I believe it's this foreigner who says that there's supposed to be this like interaction when you walk up to someone after bringing your offering and you say, "Hey, I have all this extra bread. Can I give you a loaf?" And then the person says,
"That's probably what I'm referring to." Yeah.
Like, "Thank you so much. What are you giving me this loaf for?" And then you say, "Oh, it's because God saved my life and I want to say thank you. And this is how I'm doing it." And so it's this moment of Kiddush Hashem, of sanctifying God's name. But I think it also, to your point and the point of the shir from a psychological analysis, it's a way to like create, it's a way to reframe the narrative from a near-death experience to a point, to bringing you to a point of gratitude and forcing you to articulate it to a lot of other people.
Sure.
Thank you. That's awesome. So maybe I'll stop the recording now if people want to share more thoughts or comments or questions.